Checking in again with State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy for another Tacky Talk. Hey, Tacky, how you doing?
Doing good, Joe. Happy Thursday. It is Thursday, right? The 20th. And somewhat of a cloudy day today as we start off.
I know, but no snow. And I'm not disappointed about that. I don't know about you.
I'm not disappointed by that either. Although the wind on Saturday was such a whipping cold, you could feel it all through the house.
Definitely. Yeah, that was, and we cold weather on the way too, but you know, it is end of January, so it's supposed to be cold.
Last time to the market, I remember to pick up some extra ice melt. So just in case.
Yeah. I know there were no formal Martin Luther King Jr. events in Quincy, but did you have any local groups making any kind of observations?
Not really much. I mean, I remember the Democratic City Committee did the community day on Martin Luther King Day, which is becoming actually last several years something people were doing, a community day in commemoration. I mean, a lot of stuff was being done at home or social distance type of, you know, assisting local agency situations, you know, stuff you can do at home and drop off kind of thing. But beyond that, I mean, it sounds like multiple groups try to do virtual events, you know, around the state, you know, classrooms and other places over multiple days. So, again, it's a very unusual year as we continue to year two and pandemic that you know, people are trying to do their best on celebrating, you know, one of the most important people in U.S. history, but definitely, you know, in the 20th century, if not.
Yeah, it's interesting how it's getting wrapped up in the current debate in Washington about the voting rights legislation, which appears to be dead now.
Well, it's the work of Martin Luther King and many advocates, you know, that worked with him during that time period is the impetus of why we have things like the Voters' Rights Act. You know, it is why, you know, a lot of civil rights and actually immigration laws have changed over the years. It is to brought greater awareness of a lot of inequities in the world we live in. And even though the inequities then are not the same inequities we have now, the inequities still exist. It's just, you know, we live in a different time and sometimes it's not apparent. Mm. And as we learned over the last year or so regarding BLM, but also, you know, Asian racism, as you have greater awareness of other ethnic groups, and other issues among those and how they fit into your community, you know, you suddenly become aware of something you weren't aware of. So, for example, when I, you know, talk about racism issues over time, you know, very often I get the response of, well, I didn't know that. And I'm sorry you did. I'm like, well, one, you shouldn't be sorry, because how can you be sorry for something you don't know and didn't do? And secondly, it's a failure of our education system to properly tell people about all of us, which is why there's legislation out there to bring more cultural and ethnic studies into K-12, so kids can learn a bit more about the person next to you that was never presented before, and these still go on. Now, there is a little crinkle about the Voters' Rights Act. The U.S. Supreme Court, a few years back, started peeling back some of those provisions, claiming that these inequities don't exist anymore. So I'm not an expert in this Voting Rights Act bill, but some of the parts of the bill is trying to address that these inequities still are continuing. And the law needs to be updated to represent these inequities. And I think it's been polarized to the point where it's like a Democrat-Republican thing. And that's not really it. This is not a new bill. It's like the Asian hate crimes bill and better reporting. That is not a new issue. That's been around for a long time. But until an incident in real life happens, some of these bills don't get any attention until the incident happens and realize we already had a bill to address this incident we're facing today.
Yeah.
Which is kind of the funny thing about public policy, where people have had ideas, or at least a framework of ideas, that doesn't get a lot of traction until something bad happens in the real world. And people act like this is the first time they've seen it. And I've been doing this far too long, as you can tell. So, you know, I spend too much time being a student of this business, more than anything else that I do. And, you know, that's how I remember and learn how things work and, you know, have these kind of odd observations that some folks may not see. But, you know, the filibuster obviously is the issue. I'm not going to get into this, like, philosophical debate about, you know, why filibusters exist or don't exist. But I do believe that you're going to filibuster. You should go and do it. I would believe it. If you're going to go do something, you want to go speak to your horses dry and going to collapse, go do it. I am very annoyed by this very, you know, overly gentlemanly in quotations, behavior about the fact that if you threaten to do it, we're just going to capitulate.
Yeah. It's kind of, once again, kicking the can down the road.
Well, it's basically like, you know, oh, well, you can say you want to do it, but you don't actually have to do it. So we're going to give it to you anyway. It's like, huh?
Yeah. I mean, have the courage of your convictions, right?
Can't encourage your convictions. You want to do it, go do it. I think Strom Thurmond was the last one to engage in like a true crazy filibuster. He went well into 24 plus hours. I think it was like 27.
Wow.
Stopped fighting the Civil Rights Act in the 60s, I think. I have to look it up, but someone probably out there can Google it right now, because obviously I'm talking to you right now. So, but I mean, you know, we haven't seen one like that in a long time. And, you know, in our building, if I want to stand at the podium and there's no time limits to speak, and I can go on ad nauseum as long as they don't veer off topic, meaning they can't read the phone book.
I see.
Okay. The house rules allow us to go on forever. Unless there's a time limit set in place. For example, you can't debate on challenging a rule or challenging the chair's decision for more than 15 minutes. But if it's a non-time limited debate, you know, as long as I stay on topic and relevant to the issue, you know, I can stand at the podium till I drop dead. But again, you can't open the phone book and read it.
Right. Okay. Interesting. What about here in Massachusetts, Tacky, mail-in voting, early voting? Is that getting any traction?
At this point, there is not a lot of conversation yet going on in the sense that we're having something forward moving. But the conversation is continuing, even though there's no, like, what they call, like, the conversation is going to happen. We're going to do something tomorrow. Mm-hmm. The conversation is like, you know, the day before we're going to do it. We've not had that conversation. We have had conversation continue about our interest in mail-in voting and continuation of that moving forward. We did something interesting yesterday as part of the supplemental budget that we provided for more masks in schools and testing, is that we adopted an amendment to allow remote town meeting votes. Mm-hmm. So we're not, you know, this is a city. We don't deal with town meeting, and those within towns know as representative and open town meetings. So one of the major challenges coming up is local elections. And the challenges, particularly on town meeting, because the town meeting is how towns set their budgets. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you all here in Quincy know that, you know, the mayor sets the budget, gives it to council. The council can cut, can't add, and then approve it back to the mayor. In towns, you know, the board of selectmen, the finance committee set up a budget, send it to town meeting. Town meeting can amend it, add, subtract, whatever. It's just legislative body, and then they get final approval of that budget. So as we head into the springs, even though it's not a city issue, it is of course very important to like your 300 plus other folks that aren't cities.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to allow for the house bill, and we allow for remote town meetings, which the town's going to have to figure out how to manage that. And then, you know, that proposal is now sitting in the Senate.
Hmm. Okay. Interesting. It'd be a massive Zoom call. There can be a couple of hundred town meeting members.
Yeah, I'm not sure how it works. I mean, I remember one time, I don't know if people remember the vote regarding the casinos for Native Americans down in, where was it? It was not in Taunton, where it proposed now. It was like one of the towns around Taunton.
Oh, Rehoboth, I think.
Rehoboth, yeah. I can't remember which town it was, but I mean, they decided an open town meeting on that matter. On whether to approve allowing this proposal to move forward by doing it outdoors. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what they did was they pushed everybody in essentially a giant football field situation. People for one thing would stand on one side, and then the other group would stand the other side and have to line up in a manner where the moderators could tally properly the count. Mm-hmm. And then you would use a rope to quarter them off that no one else could get in once they closed the access to voting. Once, you know, you don't get on time, you're not going to get a vote, right?
Yeah.
So once they did all that and they went through, like, you know, speeches on a megaphone, essentially, or intercoms, whatever they had, mm-hmm. you know, you could say it out. Now, I mean, it was still hundreds of people, but, you know, as we know, an outdoor setting is fairly safer. But again, I mean, the weather is dangerous here, as we know. So All I'm suggesting is, I know I'm going off track a little, but I mean, all I'm saying is that there are creative ways, depending on the size of your community as a town, to come up with ways to safely try to do town meeting. That's all.
Yeah, interesting. Okay, well, I mean, they did it, you know, years ago before technology, so there's a way to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, like I said, for better or for worse, I don't represent any towns. I still just represent you all in the city of Quincy. But as you can tell, I am paying some attention to non-Quincy issues and things like that.
Yeah. Well, as we've talked about here before, you have to support your colleagues and what their concerns are as well on Beacon Hill.
Yeah. And it's important to be a well-rounded legislator, because if you just focus on just your own little constituency, you kind of lose sight of the bigger picture of the state. And I think it's very important for all legislators to learn about other districts and other communities and other issues that does not have any relevance to your own constituents.
Yeah. Speaking of the COVID relief bill, any money in there for Quincy?
Not directly. We follow through on, well, at least the House followed through so far on the governor's desire to increase testing and mass providing masks to schools and community health centers and whatnot. So that's basically what we did yesterday. About $55 million. We took it out of the general fund. We are running a surplus, which, for the love of Pete, I still don't understand how we're running a surplus. You know, we're running a surplus for FY22 for the moment. Mm-hmm. Given the fact tax day is coming up in April, we should be okay on the surplus. The surplus is a little confusing because I was looking at Mass Taxpayer Foundation, who's been running projections. So the projection right now is like $2 billion-ish.
Okay.
But the Department of Revenue is also projecting like $600 to $700 million in refunds.
Mm-hmm.
So when you do a refund, it eats your surplus.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Right. I mean, you're getting your money back, which means
it has to come from somewhere, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. When you get your refund, it comes from somewhere. So if we got extra money in surplus, that means the refunds are going to, it's paying for your refunds.
Gotcha.
So your projection goes down to like $1.4 billion. But I mean, Mass Taxpayer Foundation, for those who know, is a business-funded organization. It's been around a very long time. It does independent analysis on the budget and revenues and debt and everything about the state. It is tends to be pro-business, but they also tend to be much more conservative in their figures.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the consensus figure number that Ways and Means and administration agreed upon, it didn't deviate that far off from Max Taxpayer Foundation numbers either. So, you know, I'm going to bring this up because I actually do read other things. It does give us a good outlook for the remainder of this fiscal cycle. And, you know, $50 million, I know it sounds like a lot of money, but you have to weigh it against the size of the surplus. It isn't that big a deal.
Yeah.
So it all puts us in a good position. So, you know, President Biden has already, announced he's going to get as many masks into people's hands as possible. You know, the state can provide money for that as well at different capacity to schools and the community health centers. And we also have a provision in there that the governor has to pursue FEMA money to reimburse the state. So we believe there's some FEMA money available for this $55 million we've now put up front. If there is money out there, the governor is required under this proposal to go get the money and then reimburse taxpayers.
Okay. Any money for the Quincy Center T station?
No, there's no cash for the T station. This is strictly a small bill to address masks and expanded testing in the state.
Okay, yeah. That's a larger price tag on that for sure.
Yeah, you already got your $50 million from the first COVID infrastructure bill that was put in there. So would there be more underway? I don't know what to tell you just yet. We are aware we still got some ARPA money left to just about under $2 billion, and we still have all that federal infrastructure money that we're still waiting for disbursements.
Stay tuned.
There's other opportunities for us to try to see where we can address some local projects.
Okay. No surprise to us, Tacky. We should be political prognosticators because today Mara Healey officially announced her intention to run for governor, something we talked about, I don't know, weeks ago.
Yeah, the big surprise is not a big surprise, right?
Right.
It's actually an interesting marketing issue. In the near term, of making announcement that everyone expected and somehow making it exciting.
I suppose, you know, it's like Christmas morning. You know, you're going to have presents. You just don't know when you're going to get to open them.
Well, that's a precise thing. You already know what's in the box.
That's right.
You know, so using the Christmas example, I mean, it's been 6 weeks of waiting for someone to open the box that you already know what's in there.
That's right.
You know, no big surprise by anybody. We do understand, you know, she is, for lack of a term, you know, the gorilla in Democratic politics. She has the most money. She has legitimate infrastructure statewide. She's got people that's been working with her in a campaign function for the last 8 years. You know, maybe she'll break the curse of treasurers and attorney generals running for governor.
Yeah.
As we know, both attorney general and treasurers have been very unsuccessful in the last, since what, like?
Oh, gosh. Scott Harshbarger.
Frank
Bellotti. Terry O'Reilly.
Yeah. People forget. I mean, we had Steve Grossman, Shannon O'Brien, Joe Malone,
Martha Coakley. So yeah.
Yeah, we've had a lot of treasurers and in attorney generals not make the cut. But let's be frank about it. I mean, the odds are her best shot at this point. She's in the best position in the Democratic primary. No offense to Sonia Chandias or Daniel Allen, both of them are fine people. But in terms of like existing infrastructure for a political campaign, Maura Healey has the existing infrastructure. You got to have people out there in different communities that can help you get elected. That's a big part of elections. It's not just money. Money's important, but you got nobody out there to advocate for you or work the local scene, even in a COVID situation. It can be very difficult.
Yeah.
But building infrastructure takes a lot of time. So that gives a strategic advantage in the Democratic primary and also in the Republican final. And I do understand that a Republican businessman has jumped into the primary as well. And I don't know anything about this guy. He was in the Globe yesterday.
Oh, I didn't see him.
Yeah, I can't remember. For love of Pete, I can't remember remember the name. I want to say it's Doherty, but I might be wrong.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, there's been a move from my Republican friends telling me that, you know, the Baker administration, you know, and the moderate and the party had been, you know, searching for candidates. You've seen balloons floated, you know, Politico and Globe and the Herald and, you know, all the other papers and news outlets, you know, with different names over the last 2 months, trial balloons, I like to call, you know, float a name up and see what the response is.
Yeah.
The reality is that unless the Republicans can find someone that, you know, can veer towards the middle, can raise a lot of money and has a decent personality, personality matters. It's going to be very challenging for them. And Maura Healey is one of the better natural campaigners I've met in my life in terms of the ability to connect with people, have a conversation, you know, just has that kind of like natural, this natural friendly quality when you meet her.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to be an interesting year for sure. Right now, I think Jeff Deal is the only kind of, unless this other person you mentioned, he's the only announced Republican candidate, but he's pretty, you know, pretty conservative.
Yeah, I serve Jeff Deal. Jeff Deal was elected the same year I was elected.
Oh. You
know, yeah, Whitman, Abington area. And I'm going to be polite about this. He did not get along with anybody and he didn't care.
Okay. And there you have it.
Yeah. Generally, when that in any kind of workplace, if you don't care about him, if you don't care about any money, anybody, and you don't care about anybody, it generally doesn't create a work environment that's helpful for you.
Right. Interesting. It raises a question now for what about the attorney general seat?
Well, you have Quentin Palfrey and you have Shannon, Liz, is it Riordan? I can't ever pronounce that second half correctly. They've already announced for attorney general. Liz Riordan, I'm hoping I pronounced that correctly. Actually, did pull papers run for U.S. Senate primary against Ed Markey last time out. She dumped in a ton of her own personal money because we can pull up her FEC, the Federal Election Commission website, and pull up her numbers. It's like, oh, that's all her money. So she's going to really give a Clinton a run for his money in terms of fundraising, especially if she's going to loan herself, you know, $500,000 plus.
Wow.
They start a campaign. And, you know, it's it doesn't seem like an exciting job, but it actually is a pretty important job in the AG's office, because it's not just about suing the presidential administrations, which is what Moore spent 4 years doing, essentially during the Trump years. But it also is a, you know, an agency that actually has to defend the state too from lawsuits. If you right. sue the North Massachusetts, the Attorney General has to take up the issue. It provides support roles for municipal and county government regarding state police and investigations. Mm-hmm. It does a degree of constituent services, consumer complaints, and fair labor issues. It attracts down people that defrauds Medicare and Medicaid. It's the advocate for consumers regarding utility rates.
Yes.
You know, it has offices in, you know, out in Boston, but also Worcester and Springfield. They have to actually travel the whole state. It's a fairly big agency in terms of traveling the state. And 99% of the job is all civil litigation. It's mm-hmm. not criminal litigation. So it's often called the top law enforcement officer, but it's really the district attorneys that does 100% criminal. And, you know, to provide, you know, a lot of support services, and I can do independent investigations. Yeah. And of course, the position itself as a title advocate, you know, when you go out and speak, you know, carries a great weight. And you also can give opinions. They're not court binding opinions, but the AG can weigh on opinions regarding legal matters. And it's done like done very much like a law school research paper. I mean, yeah. they can do things like that and give a, and again, it's not a court binding thing, but give you a legal oversight. You know, Attorney General is actually a very important position that most people don't even realize. You know, they can take on some bigger cases that small counties and municipalities can't. And
oh yeah,
and she can run a lot of civil issues, and we never hear about them defending the state. So. Right. And there's never newsworthy.
Yeah, well, I mean, the highest profile one probably was the Purdue Pharma lawsuit and the Sackler family.
Yeah, regarding the OxyContin issue.
Right.
So she's got a lot of big picture wins in her belt. She got the student loan from Navient regarding unscrupulous practices on people that delayed their student loans and the payment methods for working folks mm-hmm. on how to, you know, rearrange their loan structures. So, I mean, she's got some good wins mm-hmm. on that front. And, but, you know, I suspect during the campaign trails, some people are going to bring up some of her less than stellar wins too, some losses as well. That's the drawback of being AG. It's not like me, when you take votes, you're positioned on something. For better or for worse, I'm now positioned, right? Mm-hmm. I vote yes, I vote no. That's it. I mean, you guys are going to position me. This is what the public does. This is what the media does. That's that. Right. But in her case, you know, AG is like more like a tally. And that's, and unfortunately, it's not a good way to look at it. It really is wrong. But for simplicity, that's how people perceive it. It's a tally sheet. Mm-hmm. You lose.
Yeah. Almost like a sports team, which, you know, is unfortunate. Yeah.
It's unfortunate. It doesn't always tell you the whole picture, though. There's more nuance right. behind it. And, you know, like other government entities, you know, usually don't go in unless you're assured that your probability is extremely high that you have a case that's winnable.
Yeah. Interesting. I'm curious to see now, there's been talk that Marty Walsh will not run against Moore. So I'd be curious to see what happens there.
It is our general understanding through the rumor mill, because again, everything's a rumor right now.
Yeah.
Marty will not run if Moore runs. And this became a stare down race of who's going to go first.
That's right.
Oddly enough, Marty Walsh actually has more options in terms of future career path than Moore. You think about it carefully, because, you know, attorney generals, you know, executive branch folks generally don't like leaving the executive branch.
Right. Yeah, that's true. He was already in the legislature. So that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. So he wants to go from, you know, administration to governorship, executive. However, you know, being Secretary of Labor, regardless of whatever happens at Biden administration down the road, opens up a whole series of contacts and career opportunities beyond being the Biden administration.
Hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, including the private sector, certainly.
Oh, absolutely. And he's not an old guy. I mean, he's in his mid-50s. So
right.
Marty's got plenty of time on his hands to decide what career path was next. Governorship, you know, like I said, you don't have to do all 40 years. You can always quit in the middle. I mean, no one's holding hostage.
Yeah, we appointed an ambassador somewhere else.
Well, I mean, Claire Cronin got ambassadorship.
That's so did Paul Cellucci.
Exactly. You know, there's always that chance that he could find himself doing something different. And one of the things that was really talked about too was the fact that if somehow, you know, they're able to get back to some type of new spending plan on Build Back Better, no matter what form it comes out as, I mean, Marty Walsh will have a significant role on implementation of that programs. If somehow Congress can get their heads together on putting something out there. Marty, you know, Marty's actually in the driver's seat in many ways in terms of his career choices.
Speaking of Build Back Better, what did you think of the president's speech, Jackie?
Didn't really watch it.
Oh, okay.
We had a session yesterday, and then I got tied up with phone calls, and I was backlogged on reading stuff, and I had to make dinner, and by the time I was done, I was tired. So, hey, folks, I have, like, stuff to do, too. I mean, I am a student in this game, but I sometimes will read the news articles after the speeches, too. Okay. The whole thing. I do actually read stuff later, or I catch the relevant clips. I mean, the president's, I hate to say it, it's Groundhog Day is coming, and it feels like Groundhog Day.
Everything old is new again.
Everything old is new again. And unfortunately, it's not unsimilar. You know, this time last year, the surge was an up. Hospitalizations were very high. Death rates were very high this time last year. This time, hospitalizations are very high. Death rates aren't nearly as horrific, but still bad. I mean, talk about averaging between 40 and 50 people a day. I mean, we're hardly out of the woods in the death rate. And the average death rate is down to 73 years old, but the average death rate was once over 80 years old. It was like 81 years was the average death rate. The number going down 7 years is a big deal. Mm. You know, you say, well, it's only old people that die of COVID. No, the fact that it's moved down 7 years in the course of 2 years means that, you know, people in the 40s zone is now dying at a rapid rate to get that average down so much.
Right, yeah. It's not just in the nursing homes and hospitals anymore. So,
which is driving the original average death count. You're absolutely correct. So that's why, you know, people, you got to look at these numbers in context over time. You can't look at a context of snapshots. And I think this is what's happening now with people. They're seeing everything in a snapshot of now, not understanding the context of it all. And you got to do it as a kind of a full view of where we've been so you get an idea of, you know, I don't want to say where we're going, but I mean, an idea of how we got to today is actually a better way to put it. So the administration has a lot of challenges. He's got, obviously, you know, the COVID situation has not let up. No one could have predicted what Omicron would have been doing, but we were predicting variants were coming. Mm-hmm. This was talked about for 2 years now, practically.
Yep.
You know, he's got stalled legislation in Congress. He's got one massive win in terms of the infrastructure bill, but he stalled in the other ones. You know, there's a, unless he declares martial law, really there's no way for him to do any other federal initiatives other than putting more money into states and other entities to try to help, mitigate the damage here in COVID-19. And of course, he's got foreign affairs issues. We talked before about Ukraine. He's got the China issue. The Beijing Olympics are coming up the first week of February. He's got, all issues in South China Sea. You got reassurance your allies all over the world. You got North Korea throwing things off trains now. Launch missiles off trains. It's almost like a comic book villain at this point.
Yes. I noticed where there's now a U.S. nuclear-powered sub based in Indonesia able to launch like 20 ballistic missiles if they want to.
I mean, come on, let's be serious. I mean, North Korea relative to U.S. military capacity is a joke. I mean, you hate to be crude about it, but you know, you could level that country to the Stone Age. But the reality is, you know, the next door neighbor is going to take the brunt of it all.
That's right.
And I think, you know, people here watching should understand that our consequences of actions here affects someone else's neighbor that isn't our neighbor right now.
Yeah.
Since they don't live next to us. So you know, whatever actions we take will have repercussions to our friends in South Korea, our friends in Japan, and even our so-so not-so friends right now in China.
Yep.
Even if you don't like the government, civilians, you know, normal everyday people like we do get up and go to work are definitely affected by war.
Absolutely. Yep. There's no question.
So, I mean, we still got the Afghanistan fallout, which is not going to stop anytime soon based on UNICEF reports and UN reports about mass starvation and, you know, going backwards in time, so to speak, the Taliban rule. You still have, you know, the vaccine rollout problem on the global level. You know, the U.S., you know, needs to lead on this issue. It has been leading this issue, but we have to continue to lead more. And the U.S., you know, the last 4 years, and even you argue the last 12 years, has ceded our position as a global leader. And some people here at home think that's great. We should worry about ourselves. Well, but it's a global economy, and if you like to travel around the world, you know, being a global leader is important. You want to go vacation in the Caribbean. You want to go visit Europe. You want to go visit Asia, Australia, or anywhere else. I mean, having the U.S. as a global leader is very important. UN favorably upon when you visit.
It's why the United Nations was located in this country, right, in the first place.
Yeah. It wasn't historically, for context, people, you got to understand that historically speaking, most global issues was based out of France.
Mm-hmm.
Vienna, Austria, Paris, France, and London. And even then, Vienna and Paris were a lot of the centralization of global political conflict and global conversation were had. The fact that the U.S. has been hosting a global conversation, you know, for a better part of 70 years, 75 years now, you know, is, again, representative of where we stand in the world as a world power and a world leader.
Yeah,
but I think it's very important to us. I mean, the U.S. needs to be a world leader.
Yeah, it was all the result of World War II, really.
World War II and the U.S., you know, demonstrating that it has always been a world player. But World War II is going to show that we were really a world player, not just in name only.
Right. I
mean, this government, this country has always been a world player in trade. It's always been one of the biggest exporters in raw materials. It's always been involved in Asia. They like to keep out of Europe. Historically, the U.S. have always tried to keep out of Europe. But they were all over Asia, all over South America, you know, Africa is somewhat. But, I mean,
certainly. Yeah.
Definitely involved in Canada, definitely involved in Mexico. So, I mean, it isn't like the U.S. is just passively sitting here through history. It's not true. I mean, you know, they're very engaged in our neighbors' issues, sometimes good, sometimes bad, but also overseas as well. I mean, people forget Hawaii, you know, was basically a colony that was taken over by Dole Pineapple. I mean, read up the history of Hawaii. It is absolutely fascinating how a private corporation took over an island nation, then basically made it a state. I mean, you know.
Yeah, there was a king and queen of Hawaii.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we talk about indigenous issues or Native American issues, depending on what generation you come from. You know, Hawaii is in itself one of the most fascinating ones.
Really is. Yeah, it really is. It's true. It could have been its own country. It was, essentially.
Essentially, it was. It was a state that was not supposed to have been to be a state.
Right, right. Yeah, but certainly has proved to be an asset since, for sure. No question. Certainly strategically, militarily, but also recreationally.
Yeah. You know, people sometimes forget Hawaii exists as a, you know, how far Hawaii is actually from the United States. It's three time zones away from California. It's nine time zones. It's a six time zones away from us, I think. But it's a long flight. It is a long flight to get here, but you're absolutely right. It is an asset to U.S. On a cultural level, on a tourist level, you know, on a military level, and actually on a scientific level too. It gives us a base of operations specific. It's weather patterns. I mean, the Tongva volcano eruption, right?
That's right.
Has an impact on Hawaii, you know, as well as throughout the West Coast of the United States. So, you know, it's a fascinating history of how that came to be.
Yeah. Closer to home, it's now official. You've been saying it already, but the Lunar New Year Festival is unfortunately going virtual. It's been postponed to a couple of weeks, I think.
Yeah, unfortunately. I know that the Arakan numbers are going down. The wastewater treatment numbers have been pretty good. For those who don't know, we've been monitoring the MWA sewage rates out in Deer Island. You can actually detect viruses in your sewage. Again, it's one of the places where you can get transmission, unfortunately, through wastewater. It does only represent the largest communities in the Commonwealth, which is probably about more than a third of the state.
Yep.
Because MWRA is not in every community. Those are in septic systems or other types of sewage wastage wouldn't be detected by this method. Right. But it's a big enough sample. It's a big enough sample that gives us a clue what's going on.
Yes, so, 46 cities and towns in the greater Boston area, and as it said, the most populated ones.
Yeah, so it gives a big enough sample. So that's a good indicator. But again, it's not a steep decline. It's going to be a curve.
Yeah.
You know, it was a curve, and it became a spike, and now it's going to be a curve. And as we end the curve, it'll probably be a drop like we saw last time. Well, we hope.
We hope, right.
The last time, don't forget, we had vaccination going full blown.
Yep, that's true. That's right. And now we're in very, very good shape in this state, vaccination percentage-wise, at least, and boosters, too, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, this state is well into 80%, you know, 80-85% first dose. We're over 75% second dose. Mm-hmm. Booster numbers are a little bit tricky because... not like they're not recording it, but it's a little bit weird trying to figure that one out because I look at the spreadsheet. I'm kind of like, okay, where is it? But the numbers are, I think it's into the 30 percentile range.
Yeah, now that younger kids can get them too, it'll start to go up, I think.
Yeah, because every time I look at the chart, I'm like, where's the booster part again? It's just adding more columns to the chart.
Oh, right, exactly, yeah.
When I look at it, I'm like, and you're like, you can sort by age and short by gender, short by ethnic makeup. There's all kinds of data out there.
It's another bar on the graph, basically.
It is. It's just trying to sort out where it is on the graph. It's fine. It's not a big deal. Just try to figure out how to read it all.
Yeah.
It's just there's so much of it is the challenge, right? So, but I mean, this is definitely ahead of the curve state. You know, we're up there with Puerto Rico's high up there, Vermont's high, Maine is very high, Rhode Island's very high, Connecticut's very high. So the New England area is actually highly, highly vaccinated. And, you know, it's reflected in the fact that as much as our hospitals were in crisis, we're able to manage the crisis. Again, it's a tough role, but second time we've managed a major hospital overrun crisis. And the death count, again, is still not good, but we're not doing 100 a day.
Yeah, exactly. And let's hope we never do again. Mm. We talk a bit about the economy, Jackie. Do you think the Fed should raise interest rates?
No one wants to hear about raising interest rates. Yeah, I think they're going to definitely raise interest rates. You can say between 3, maybe 4-ish times. I don't know how many times they're going to do it. We've all felt this at home, folks. You felt higher energy prices. You felt higher prices at grocery stores. You've seen it at the pump. As the economy, you know, suddenly turned itself back on a global level, demand was high everywhere, and supply chain problems ranging from, I don't know, people that aren't alive anymore that used to do those jobs, to folks that are doing career changes. Expanded benefits, but government benefits is long gone. I mean, people are using that excuse, but that ended back in September, and all tapered off by the 10th of October. So, you know, unemployment rate in Massachusetts in December is, I think, 5.2. Nationally, unemployment is like 3.9. Mm-hmm. So unemployment's declining. And I know some people, you know, may have retired and retired from unemployment. I do get that. But, you know, there is a combination of like every bad factor, so to speak, economically for a business. You have labor shortage, you have to pay people more money. You have energy price and supply of goods and supply chain problems, you know, jacking up prices. Not enough truck drivers even move domestic goods locally, or people changing their jobs, you know, rather than drive a truck, you want to drive, you know, local UPS. I mean, Uber drivers are still affected by this because of the nature of COVID-19. I mean, mm-hmm. even gig workers are having challenges in you know, hospitality is still in a very tough shape in Boston, as well as restaurants and hotels and wedding venues and things like that. So, you know, we're not quite out of the woods. And Massachusetts, again, is a three pillar economy. Our base of economies: education, healthcare, and tourism. Tourism still isn't functioning properly. Healthcare is just being crushed. And education is higher ed is a big part of our economy, and they're all discombobulated still.
Yeah, they're kind of waffling. Don't know what, you know, hybrid, remote, in person. It's different at every school right now.
It is. It's a very challenging situation because they're a big part of our influx of outside money in our local economy. So, that's the three major pillars of our economy. And generally, because of those three pillars, if we have a conventional recession, generally education and healthcare can hold us through if tourism goes down. Something happens to education, people move around, we still get tourism. Film industries, for example, is part of tourism now. So, we still haven't recovered our big three economic sectors completely. And then the remaining sectors are things like exporting of complex machinery, which again, supply chain, and then exporting, believe it or not, food. We're a big food exporter because—
A lot of agriculture in Massachusetts, sure, yeah.
Yeah, and again, supply chain, we can't get stuff moving.
Yeah, well, they're talking now about letting 18-year-olds drive 18-wheelers. I don't know about that.
I don't know.
Yeah.
The answer is I don't know either. Sure, I guess. Why not? I don't know. I just don't know what the answer to that one is. But you're right. I mean, it's getting to that point where people really need to change how they think about workforce development. At our level, too, we need to really talk more about COVID has impacted our economy in a manner we have to rethink our workforce.
Yeah. I think the vaccine mandate in Boston is going to fly.
My opinion of a policy on that is that if you're going to do a vaccine mandate, you got to do when your vaccinations are starting. And people say, well, you're trying to incentivize people to get vaccine. Yeah, but it's more important is the fact that if you do it when your vaccinations are going up, when the next wave hits, you're prepared, already business ready, prepared for the impact of a variant.
Yeah.
And, it also only works well if you do not have anywhere else to go.
Mm.
So we're going to use New York as the example because it's the most prominent example. Once you leave New York City lines proper, where are you going to go to get something else?
Good point. Yeah.
Right. Your entertainment, your shopping, your workplace, all is hyper-centralized in New York City. It's not like you go 15 miles out of New York City, you find something else that you would be at, right? It's basically a country in itself. The problem here is Massachusetts, and I think everyone's familiar with this, I hope, is that since we're such an interconnected state by municipality where there's no gaps in the middle, everyone touches each other, essentially. Unless you get to the Berkshires, everyone really touches it. You only have to cross one time from one city and town to do business somewhere else, and the rules are different.
Yep.
So I'll give you a couple of past examples. One, I think, example everyone understands best is the smoking ban, right? So for people who are too young to know this, because I think that at this point there are people too young to know this, watching this perhaps, that this was an indoor smoking state. And over time, there was a move to no longer allow indoor smoking in public buildings and airplanes. And it was a gradual process. It wasn't like a magic overnight issue.
Right.
And municipalities started prohibiting smoking inside restaurants and other businesses over time. And eventually, at one point, more than one third of municipalities had decided to not allow smoking, which then the state created a uniform standard around doing that. But why do I bring that up? Well, if you have a smoking ban in one community, you don't want to use that restaurant. You go to the next community that has no smoking ban, which could be just next door. Same thing in alcohol. When bar time closes, I think Quincy people are very familiar with this. Bar time closes is different between Quincy and Boston. Bars close at 2 o'clock in Boston, they close at 1 o'clock in Quincy.
Yeah.
You want to get the extra pop, you go over the Neponset Bridge into Dorchester. And you get your nightcap between 1 and 2 in the morning.
Right.
Don't tell me this doesn't happen, folks.
Of course it does. It has for years. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm aware of this. So this is the same issue regarding the vaccine mandate, because the nature of how our economy is intertwined in our geography, all it does is really give people alternative options who do not want to be hassled by the concept of having to provide vaccination identification to just stay in a municipality around it. Now, if this was a statewide mandate, the border communities on Rhode Island, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Vermont, New York would have a different effect because the border communities will go back and forth. This is actually issues regarding like alcohol purchases, right? As to what I deal with. Even with a border state, the alcohol purchases and even supermarket issues are different. For example, people in Rhode Island like to shop in Massachusetts because our sales tax is lower, believe it or not, in Rhode Island. Mm. You know, is it still lower?
I don't know.
I think we're still lower. But conversely, you're boarding in New Hampshire. People go into New Hampshire because they have no sales tax and alcohol.
Right. Yeah.
Right. So the principle is the same. If there's incentivization not to go to a place because of cost or inconvenience, you're going to do it.
Oh, so it could be good for Quincy, actually.
Yeah, it's good for businesses surrounding Boston. And she timed, you know, this proposal very confusingly as during the holiday period. It didn't really take effect too recently. There was a lot of confusion about what was going on going into it.
Mm.
Right. And, you know, like I said earlier, if you have a situation like New York where there's just New York and there's really nothing else.
Unless you go to New Jersey, right.
Yeah, let's go and make a long drive to Jersey.
Right.
And again, they did it when vaccinations was beginning. I mean, it was at the onset of mass vaccinations. You know, it gives you the ability to start contact tracing and buffering against any future major infections. So in the public policy, I get it. As a practical mutation, I don't think the timing is quite right. And you know, people have been getting emails, people vowing against vaccine passports. And I'll tell you this, if you don't want to travel to Europe or any Asian country or Australia and maybe Canada, and don't want to go to Caribbean, fine. I mean, you can advocate against vaccine passports. This is not going to be a domestic issue. It's going to be an international issue. Depending on where we go down the road on whatever happens next with this COVID virus mutation, variant, whatever, countries that are major tourist destinations for us, United States and here in Massachusetts, and if you want to even go on a student trip or a business trip, you know, those countries are going to be very hesitant allowing these viruses in. Because they've seen the havoc ravages of smaller economies. So, yeah, fine. I mean, you can advocate against vaccine passports, but prepare to never go anywhere again.
Mm. Okay. There's a shining outlook.
Well, it's true. I mean, again, we're so provincial in our mentality here about this stuff. And people get caught up on this like little bubble of their world. Well, if you want to go visit the rest of the world, well, don't.
Mm.
I mean, they're not concerned about you. They're concerned about protecting their own folks. And if you bring something in there, as we've seen in Italy, in the UK, in the US, you know, all through Southeast Asia, Australia, you know, one Omicron case has got into China and they locked down 20 million people. Yeah. One Omicron case. Right. And now they got three floating in Beijing, of which they do not know where it came from. And they're putting out the false narrative that it came off frozen food. I'm sorry, a package from Canada somehow survived going from Canada to Hong Kong to Beijing over like a week. And the virus was still on the package that actually infected somebody, which is not possible. The odds are minuscule that many hand transfer of a package could still carry an Omicron virus. So, you know, leading up to the Beijing Olympics, you know, the Chinese government is now in real concern. About an Omicron spread. So they're concerned about a package, which I believe is a false narrative. Mm. Imagine you, as a business person or a tourist or a student trying to visit. Just saying, folks, I mean, they're not the outlier. We're going to be the outlier if we don't come up with a mechanism of screening people who come from out of country to visit us here.
Okay, it's going to be an interesting 2022 for sure.
Yeah. We need an effective way. The federal government needs an effective way to best identify folks that are vaccinated coming into the United States as part of entry. And to do that, we also require reciprocation of the country the person is coming from to provide the same courtesy to U.S. citizens going to their country.
Yeah,
and that is going to have to happen because the idea of having another variant come through in a untraceable manner down the road is not acceptable. And, you know, that's what happened to Omicron. It didn't take long for that to just completely take over the planet in less than a month.
Right.
Delta took over in less than 2 months. Alpha took over the place, you know, even less than that. I mean, well, actually more than that. Alpha took a lot longer than that. But I mean, you know, the initial ground zero of COVID was the came out of Europe, didn't come from China. You know, because in New York, you know, they identified the genome back to the RNA sequencing back to UK.
Yeah, well, look, the whole goal, I think, is to avoid another variant that would evade the vaccines completely.
Agreed. And to do that, we got to have a better understanding where people are coming from, visiting us from overseas. People overseas want a better idea when we visit them, and they'll want to be able to find us in case something's up, because the idea of 2-week quarantine or 3-week quarantines, even 5-day quarantines of visiting another country, is not good for the economy.
It's not practical either. Usually you're visiting for that length of time completely, so you're not going to quarantine for that length of time.
Yeah, and that keeps people from spending the money in your local economy. So it's impractical. It's so impractical. Why would you want to do it?
Right. All righty. Anything else this week, you think, Taggy?
Let's see here. Next week, we could talk about the governor's state address. It'll be the last state of state address. Mm-hmm. Doing it at the Heinz Convention Center, or RSVP only, limited access. I am not going to that. I've been to the Heinz Convention Center. If you visit the Heinz, you know why I don't want to go. It's not a safe place.
Pretty old, too.
It's very old. So I understand why they chose the venue, but no, I've been in the Heinz enough times to know why I don't want to go to the Heinz.
Yeah, you watch them on TV with everybody else.
Yeah, I'm okay with that. You know, we have the governor's budget coming out next Wednesday, the 26th.
Okay.
So his proposal, it's not the budget, it's just a proposal that you would like to ask us for in the House. So it's a recommendation, as we like to call it. Joint Route 10 is coming up on the 2nd of February. So, you know, obviously when we get to the month of February, we can talk more about bills that came out of committee or didn't come out of committee.
Okay.
What else? Today, I actually have my meeting with the speaker regarding, as a chair, discussing bills in committee and what's going on and my thoughts about how things are working. So I actually do have a speaker's meeting to give my thoughts on matters and have a discussion about, you know, how we're going to set an agenda for the next few months. I do get to weigh in. What actually happens, well, we'll see as we go, as I like to say.
You make your recommendations.
My recommendations. Like I said, recommendations. And then we'll obviously start the budget process in mid-February when we start having our conversations internally. There's a capital bond bill the governor filed for state buildings and technology upgrades and things like that. You know, that is actually a very big comprehensive bill. We haven't done a capital building a bond, I think, in over 5-6 years now, maybe even longer. So, we'd be curious to see how that starts to pay out a bit.
Is the Quincy Courthouse in that, do you know?
Off the top of my head, I don't know. I did remember seeing public safety. There was environmental components, there's technology upgrades. There was maintenance on state buildings that had not been dealt with in a while. Mm. I'm trying to go through the list in my head now. I don't remember if there's a courthouse in there. I have to look.
Well, that'll be homework for next week.
I'll look at that. So, yeah, no, there's a few things going on, you know, at our level. That's keeping me plenty busy, as you can imagine.
Yes. So you need get your rest, Jackie.
Oh yeah. Nomination papers. We set a date for the primary.
Oh, September something?
September 6th.
Okay.
I think it's the first Tuesday after Labor Day.
Okay. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. So we put it in the COVID bill yesterday, sent it to the Senate. Hopefully the Senate will act quickly in next week or so. And Secretary Galvin can print his nomination papers and we'll have them ready by mid-February. And I'm going to grab my 150 Democrat or unenrolled signatures to get myself back on ballot. So yes, folks, I am running again.
That's the worst kept secret in this podcast, Jackie.
You guys all want me to say I'm running for something else. Get the first scoop against Stato's news service.
I wouldn't be objected to that, but you know, that's up to you. Yes, I'd be happy to provide the State House News Service with that footage if they wanted it. But it looks like we're stuck with you here in Quincy.
Yeah. I'm working on seeing if you're stuck with me for at least a couple more years.
Okay, that sounds good. Far, far from being stuck, that's for sure. How do folks get in touch with you, Tacky?
Well, give us a call at 617-722-2014, 617-722-2014. Mash a button, staff will get it. We get the voicemails actually emailed to us. Last few voicemails, I'm not saying it's anyone that's watching done it to us, but you know, please leave us a phone number.
It's really basic, but we still, yeah, have to get a hold of you.
It'd be kind of to leave us a phone number to get back to you. It'd be helpful.
Yeah.
You can email me at tacky.chan@mhealth.gov, tacky.chan@mhealth.gov. I'll get through the emails. It's just so many of them. I'll get to them. And State Representative Tacky Chan, Facebook page has some somewhat useful information on there some days. They can look at stuff and watch my public hearings. We're planning an executive session for the last Monday this month, which I think is the 31st.
It is, yep.
Once we finalize that, you can watch our executive session prior to Joint Route 10 if you want to watch that. We'll have a defined time once we get to next week's podcast. And of course, tackychan.org. Which would provide some just reference numbers and contact information. You can find some local phone numbers and service agencies. And of course, Cable TV here, where you know, have our weekly chats or every 2 week chat about, you know, life and whatever's going on. So
life in tacky world. Yes. Tacky world. This is the unplugged version of Tacky Chan. I still want your mom to make a cameo appearance someday.
Oh, I mean, we can arrange it here with mom if you want. It's not a problem. It sounds like we're going anywhere at the moment.
We'll get the real story then. Exactly. All right. Thanks, Tacky. Good to talk to you as always.
Good to talk to you, Joe. I'll talk to you soon.